morning, everybody. I'm Michael Green, one of the clerks at Green's List. Thank you very much for getting up on a wintry morning to come here early for our family law breakfast briefing. My job is just to briefly introduce the introducer. Paul Ross is our chair today. Paul, a lot of you would know Paul, of course, as being family law practitioners yourselves. Paul has very kindly agreed to chair our breakfast briefing this morning. Paul's a family law expert, both through LIV accreditation and also through practising as a family lawyer for the past 20 years. He's been a principal in his own firm since 2000, initially Westminster Lawyers, where he was a director, then a partner at Holding Redlich, and then Paul, I think, with in agreement with Holding Redlich, they took the family law department from Holding Redlich and commenced the firm of Blackwood Family Lawyers, which where Paul has seven family law specialists, including himself, and they practice in the area. I should also say Paul has a particular involvement with international family law matters. He is a Francophone, he speaks French, so that helps him in that area. So please welcome and with me thank Paul Ross for chairing this morning.
It's a bit like a Monty Python skit to have an introducer for the introducer. My job apparently is like in the movies to say, could we all turn off our mobile phones and not rustle our popcorn too loudly? But other than that, I'd like to introduce our first speaker, Richard Edmonds, who will be leaving us midway because he has to get into his helicopter to fly down to finish off a matter in Geelong this morning. Richard, as a solicitor, had his own firm in Gippsland before coming to the bar about 25 years ago, which is less than you get for murder, let alone armed robbery. He practices not only in family law, but he has a wills and probate practice. He practices also in civil and commercial litigation, particularly in property, partnership, contract and building disputes. He has a mediation practice and brings that breadth of commercial knowledge to the family law matters in which he appears. And Richard is coming to talk to us about the relocation list in the court's new guidelines.
Thanks, Paul. And although I might have a background that includes some commercial matters, this morning's got nothing to do with commercial proceedings. The relocation list, I don't know if anyone here has had any matters in the relocation list in Melbourne. In about May of this year, I was briefed in a children's matter that was initially before one of the federal judges now, and the solicitors who were representing the applicant, who was living in Victoria but wanting to move to Tasmania, and those solicitors were in Tasmania, had sought to have the matter transferred to the relocation list. My instructor said, "I've never heard of the relocation list." And me, being the font of all knowledge, said, "Neither have I." It's a fairly recent development. It's one of a number of developments that the Federal Circuit Court is trying to assess, or is assessing, to see how effective it is in dealing with discrete issues. In Melbourne, at the Melbourne Registry, it's the only one in Australia at the moment that has got a discrete relocation list, and two of the federal judges, Judge Maguire and Judge Hartnett, are currently operating that list. In Brisbane, they're running a similar project, but in relation to contravention cases. And they're being run as pilot cases for a period of some 12 months for the court to assess how effective they are and whether they can then be implemented throughout the registries across Australia. What I've done is obtained a copy, I don't know if everyone's got one, but a copy of the printout from the Federal Circuit Court as to what this list is all about. This morning's presentations are intended to be 10-minute sessions that really just give everyone a quick overview of specific areas. And in relation to this area, it is probably easier simply to just run through what the court's requirements are. And note that this is really not the answer to every relocation case, but intended to fast track cases that really have as their main issue a relocation proceeding. The purpose is stated as being to meet the needs of children who'd be prejudiced if their carers are unable to expeditiously obtain a decision when seeking orders permitting them to change the place of residence of children, where such a change would result in the parent being unable to comply with existing parenting orders or arrangements. And noting commonly there'd be a need for an expeditious determination, such as an offer of employment, transfer of place of employment of a parent or other significant person in the life of a parent or child. So it's not essential that you actually have an existing parenting order in place, because the guidelines refer to parenting orders or arrangements. And the principles that guide the proceedings in this list are that the time and expense devoted to a proceeding should be proportionate to the real issues in the proceeding. Cooperation, communication, civility and common sense should prevail amongst all parties and counsel. All parties should comply strictly with directions and court orders for the preparation and presentation of a case. Now, that guideline is fairly critical to this list, particularly in relation to the consequences of parties failing to comply with guidelines. Matters should be listed for trial as quickly as possible, which is the obvious reason they've got this discrete quick list. And cases should be determined expeditiously, usually with orders made within 7 days and reasons provided thereafter on request. So it is a fast-track process. Matters that will be heard in the relocation list have set out a number of mandatory criteria. Case involving an application for residence or contact orders. Substantial issue being one in which person with primary care or majority care or shared care seeks to change the residence of a child, and that the existing orders or arrangements would be impracticable or unworkable. An important factor is that the applicant is able to fund their own report, unless they've got an existing grant of legal aid to do so, by way of a private family report. There is a provision that if someone genuinely cannot fund that report, the parties may apply to the court, and the court may refer the matter to the Internal Court Reporting Service. However, the emphasis really is on the ability to fund your own report. If someone can afford to fund it, and the court generally looks at it saying, well, if you can afford to pay lawyers to represent you, you can afford to fund your report. It'll be probably the rare case rather than the norm that people will be getting a referral to the court's service. On the other side of the coin, those cases that aren't transferred to the relocation list will involve matters involving unresolved allegations of sexual abuse, unresolved allegations of serious mental health issues, significant child protection issues that have previously warranted intervention by the Department of Human Services within the previous 12 months, or significant other unresolved issues. So you're really looking at a fast-tracking of a case that is focused really on the relocation aspect rather than a case that has relocation as part and parcel of a whole lot of other messy matters before the court. The process is by way of an application, affidavit and financial statement filed in the relocation list. You can request the matter be transferred. And in fact, if it's in the normal duty list and it is really just a relocation list proceeding, you can ask for the matter to be transferred to the relocation list, and the judge will generally transfer it straight away on the basis of it being just a relocation proceeding. The question in relation to responses and affidavits, filing of documents, there's a schedule of directions or orders that will be made. Usually the response must be within 14 days. Affidavits will have to be filed within the timeline. There'll be a directions hearing by the duty judge that sets out the timetable, the obtaining of a report, the date for a trial. Importantly, if anyone, once you've got into this list, wants to adjourn a proceeding once it's listed for trial, the court's unlikely to do that, even if it's by consent, unless there are compelling reasons to convince the court to do so. You may find if you're asking for an adjournment, it'll be adjourned out of the list back into the duty list, unless it's a very brief adjournment for a very good reason. The party can also seek what are called urgent interlocutory orders, and you must file your trial documents in accordance with the directions orders. If you want any further information, go to the Federal Court website. If you want to look at what's happening in Brisbane in relation to contravention proceedings and their specific list, if you have a case in that registry, look at those guidelines, because you'll be able to fast track your application there. Keep an eye on the publications from the court, because if the court is comfortable with the way it is being processed and operating, it will continue, and they are likely to start up these other specialist lists, such as the contravention list in Melbourne. Currently, the process is being overviewed by Deputy Chief Judge of the Federal Circuit Court of Australia, which is a bit of a mouthful, Michael Bowman. He seems to be a judge who Peter and I met at a conference recently, who seems to be a very active, involved and overworked judge, who seems to have far too many hours in the day that's good for him, that he spends working. And he looks at the performance of this new list. He also looks at the performance of every Federal Circuit Court judge in Australia and gets reports on how everyone is performing, how long they're taking to hear cases, how long it's taking for matters to go through their lists. So this is a new initiative. It is being looked at closely by the Deputy Chief Judge, and I suspect it's a list that will continue after the 12-month period. Excuse me. I think that's 10 minutes.
Just before you sit down, Richard, I think we have some questions. Robert has a question.
Richard, I'd just like to see a show of hands if anybody's had a matter from the relocation list in which they've been attempting to stop a party relocating and succeeded. On the stats that I got from Federal Magistrate Hartnett's chambers, 99% go, the balance stay or settle in some mixed form. So if you want to go at the moment, just book your tickets.
Either that or they've got good basis for leaving.
Richard, I had an analogous question, which is we've just had the horse racing season, so I'm interested in a form guide. If you're a person who wanted to either go or stop someone going, do you think you are more likely to get a different result from the family court to the Federal Circuit Court, given our current benches in Melbourne?
Well, given that this list has just got two judges, you've probably got a little bit of certainty at the moment as to the... might say you have a gut feel how those two judges might be dealing with cases, as opposed to, I think there are six family court judges who might be dealing with matters in the family court. I guess if you were looking at going, particularly going overseas with a family, if you've got a valid case and it is just because I want to go overseas because my husband, wife has got a job in London or Singapore and I have to go there, it's a valid reason, or I've been posted there because of a military posting or something that requires me to move. Yeah, bring your application in the relocation list. But if you fall within one of those categories that have got the mishmash of other related issues such as sexual abuse or a whole range of other issues tied into the case, it won't be heard expeditiously in the list, or according to the guidelines anyway, it won't be heard expeditiously, and you can then pick which court you'd prefer to go in. But if you want to leave quickly, as Robert's saying, you've got a 99% chance of getting out of where you are. Mind you, if you just want to, you've got a client who wants to leave to go to Tasmania, for example, not because of work-related issues, not because of family-related issues, perhaps even if that person is leaving behind not only the former partner, but also their own extended family, their parents, their brothers, their sisters, and their sole, and they don't have any work to go to, but their sole reason for wanting to go there is perhaps a bit of spite or dislike of maybe the new partner's new partner, the old partner's new partner. In other words, a case that's got very little merit to it, I would think that would be one of those 1%ers that don't get through.
Thank you, Richard.
I just see one question. Take a question before I...
I'm just wondering, this reference to expeditiousness in the terms, do you think that if you've got a case where your argument is, look, I'm going home to family, or something that doesn't have an urgent nature about it, there's no particular date, but I want to be back with the people who, you know, the community that I know, and maybe I've got a house and garden financial matter as well. I don't have these issues of violence and abuse. Is this list for those kind of matters, or are they just not urgent enough?
It's really intended to be for people who have to move. In fact, it's set out in the first...
Yes. So just... seems to say it's only that kind of relocation case, not any relocation.
Yes, not every... excuse me. It is meant to be for cases that have got some degree of urgency, whether it's relating to employment, significant family reasons for moving. I suspect that if one wants to move for very little reason other than I just want to move, you may not convince the court that it should be transferred there. But if an applicant says I want to have it put in the relocation list and the other party is also keen to have it dealt with quickly rather than having to go through a very long process, and they take the view, well, this is not a very meritorious case anyway, you might find that both parties will say, well, let's get it dealt with quickly instead of going through however many months it might take otherwise. Now, I'm sorry, I do have to... it's not so much a helicopter, but a fast car at this moment. head off to Geelong. But thanks for your time.
Thank you, Richard.
Our next speaker is Joanne Piggott. Joanne Piggott has been a practising lawyer for 26 years and 18 years of that at the bar. I'm not sure, are you still studying Masters of Law?
Or I finished it about.
Finished it?
Hasn't been updated.
The relief. In addition to a very extensive family law practice, Joanne has specialist knowledge with health and medical law. She's done some criminal cases in the county and magistrates court, and that I think is particularly relevant to what she's talking about today, which is the admissibility of evidence. I think they're it would be fair to say they're far more rigorous about the admissibility of evidence in the criminal jurisdiction than they are in some of the family law jurisdiction. A pretty stellar career, a gilt-edged career. Herbert Gere and Rundle, the Office of Public Prosecutions, where Joanne was Assistant Legal Advisor to the Chief Commissioner of Police, Victorian Government Solicitor, Attorney General's Department. You cannot get better advice than this, and Joanne has come to talk to us about the irrelevant and inadmissible material in affidavits and how to avoid those mistakes.
Thanks, Paul. Ladies and gentlemen, what I'm about to say to you is probably something you already know anyway, but it may be termed how to control a client and what affidavits are not. Affidavits are not what the client wants to tell the court. They're really not, let me tell the court how much I dislike my partner or how he should not have the children or how he's treated me very poorly for the last X number of years. It goes without saying that the affidavit is a witness's evidence in chief. And as Paul said, the rules perhaps in the Family and Federal Magistrates Circuit Court are not so rigorously applied, particularly in relation to Section 69, capital ZT, and children's matter, where the court does not have to perhaps apply the strict rules of evidence under Section 55 and 56 of the Evidence Act. The starting point in a good affidavit, I would encourage you to go backwards. What are you trying to prove, or what orders do you want, and how are you going to prove it? Might sound simple, but I think it sets the scene on how to perhaps avoid some of the irrelevant material that tends to creep in, usually because the client says, this is what happened to me, I'm very angry about it, or this is what a bad time I've had over the past X number of years. So if you perhaps start with, okay, these are the orders I want on behalf of my client, maybe it would be the children have a week about or supervised custody with dad or certain property orders. And then you are looking at, well, how do I get or persuade the federal magistrate, court or judge to provide those orders? And the next step, I would say, what do I need? What evidence? And that's what it really is. It's the evidence. It's not a tirade of abuse. It's not X, Y, and Z. And I think the next step is to say, all right, I need some evidence. What do I need? Write a list of what things you might need. And then start interviewing or talking to the client. Unfortunately, large chunks of long paragraphs with a lot of detail don't really assist the judicial officer. They're hard to read, and if you consider that any judge or magistrate reads thousands and thousands of affidavits during their career, anything that can make the judge's life easier and perhaps present them with an easier task is, in my view, part of the way of making them remember and be more accepting of your client's version of events. One of the difficulties is that, and it's obvious, the judges decide on evidence and facts. The client is not a lawyer. They don't know the distinction. And so they tend to say, well, Mrs. Brown told me that Mrs. Smith saw or said something, et cetera, and it becomes into the realm of second and third hand hearsay. The other thing that is that one of the other problems is assertions of opinion, such as he's a drug addict, he's a drunk, he hides his money, he's a tradesman, and he has payment in cash. It's all very well that they all may be quite correct and accurate matters to put in and present in an affidavit. But there has to be the foundation. So I'd say that a couple of the very tripping stones are opinion without the supporting facts and hearsay. And the third would be irrelevant material. And just ask a couple of questions that can be asked of the client in relation to the hearsay is to confine themselves to what they saw with their own eyes and heard with their own ears. And it does bring them back a little bit into perhaps focusing not on, oh, well, he was this, or I think, or he probably did this, or I probably did that. It's, well, what did you see? What did you hear? And that draws it back into something that is perhaps more in the realms of admissible evidence. Opinion evidence. The husband or wife's opinion about whether the other party has a particular mental illness, bad habit or whatever, has to be based on something they saw, heard, and then again that comes into play. And it's a good idea to set out the topic. Drug addiction, well, how can you prove it? What did they see? What did they hear? And then move on. Including facts and not opinions is something that it often gets lost in the affidavits, and thus, as a result of that, what you're trying to prove is often given very little weight by the person reading the affidavit. Some of the other materials that can creep in are highly prejudicial matters. For example, there was an affidavit in which I was dealing, and the husband's sexuality he'd come out as being gay, and there was an enormous amount of material which was highly prejudicial about his behaviour, where he went, nightclubs, who he was associating with, and it does very little to advance the case, highly prejudicial, and puts a really nasty tinge on and detracts from the other matters which you may have good factual basis for. When assertions are made by clients as to an opinion, I'll give you a very simple example, mental illness or drug addiction, what are the other sources that you can use? It's no good on the last day of or on the final day of a hearing the client saying, oh, I've got 100 people who could say he's a drug addict, or I've got 100 people who could say that the person gets money in cash. Find out that early, get the names of the people, and if possible, a short affidavit attesting to factual matters rather than innuendo, gossip and the like, which often tends to creep in. On the topic of hearsay, I think if anyone, there's a book written by Peter Farris, and I can't remember the other person who I should do, which has some very good chapters on it, ladies and gentlemen. It's got stick figures. So if the concept of hearsay you find a little bit difficult, it has a couple of very good pages with little stick figures talking about red lights and cameras. And I think picture paints a thousand words might be a good idea if you're not strong on that, and it can be difficult at times. Have a look at the book, and it even is very good, I think, to show the client or explain it in those ways to the client. Sometimes there are matters which should be by affidavit, such as a letter from an employer saying, I will let Mr. Bloggs work flexible hours from 8 until 2 on whatever days so that he can pick up the children. That's hearsay. Better to have, or to be admissible, it really needs to be in a short affidavit form. Same material, short affidavit. Now, there are exceptions to the hearsay rule as far as unavailable witnesses, etc. I've looked at them in the context of the family law matters, and they would probably not very commonly arise. They're more to do with witnesses being unavailable through expense. They're witnesses who are dead or medically unavailable. So there's probably not a lot that you really need to concentrate on that area. Another irritation for judges, apart from the extremely irrelevant material, is repetitive. If you can say something clearly, simply once and give examples in short form, do it. Don't keep coming back throughout the affidavit. After a while, the judge or federal magistrate will become reasonably numb and it loses its impact. Don't include matters which are more of a way of submission, saying that I think the court should award the children to me, you know, and these are the reasons that, you know, I'm a better parent and he doesn't do this, he doesn't do that. Not necessarily, that's for your counsel to do when they're on their feet, and again, detracts from the material. In drafting the affidavit, no need to comment or debate on evidence that's either in your opponent's affidavit or in your affidavit. Again, detracts and can tend to lead into irrelevancies creeping in. A few tips, short paragraphs and sentences, one fact per paragraph, use simple language, how, when, where and how, when, where and why, and they're the sort of questions one asks once one is leading evidence from a witness in the witness box. What did you see? When did you see it? How did that come about? Those simple, short questions will ensure, if you ask them while you're drafting or eliciting instructions, that the material is admissible. A couple of words I would say don't use ever, and they are never and always. The sweeping suggestions that he never picked the children up from school or I always did, sooner or later, as sure as eggs, your client will be in the witness box and there'll be that one occasion that they didn't. And once the crack in credit has been made, it's a perfect opportunity for a bit more chipping away on each various point. Check the dates and the facts. I've got a case running in the county court at the moment. Three people swore black and blue that the young boy left a particular college at the end of first term in 2009. And that set the scene for a whole lot of other events that unrelated to him leaving school. In the witness box in cross-examination, the mother was handed a VCAT document, her own document, and then the response from the school. A particular person left end of term two in year 10, and there was a silence. It threw the client's credit, and after that she was quite shattered, quite uncertain, and was able to be chipped away at on a lot of other times and dates. So check your dates, check the facts, use the chronology, and try to keep those how, when, where, and why questions when you're extracting evidence or information from your client. Again, reinforce it's not what they thought, it's not what they believed, it's what they saw, what the facts were, and any conclusion that they came to, drunk, mentally unstable, has to be supported by what they saw with their own eyes. For example, mentally unstable, what did you see? When did you see it? What did you hear? What did you do? What did he do? And rather than opinion, and it keeps things much cleaner, much simpler, and also under cross-examination, less likely to cause difficulties. Another probably general tip is if you keep the facts in there and they're clean, then there's less likely, once the client has adopted the affidavit, that they are going to be tripped up. Many times people get into the witness box, yes, they've said they've read the affidavit, yes, it's all true and correct, yes, and then when asked about it, they really can't remember the details. Too much detail can be a bit of a trap, and when they've been asked, oh, well, what did you do? What did he do on the night of the party or whatever? I really can't remember. Or they give a version that is quite different or significantly different to the one that they've just attested to. I know that's really not on the admissibility issue or irrelevancies, but it is one of the traps and one of the things that in drafting you should be aware of. Keep it simple, keep it clean, keep it to the how, when, where and how, why. And also remember, it's not the client in control. It is not their role to be saying, well, this is what I want to tell the court. Sometimes very difficult for solicitors. Often it's a lot easier for barristers. I mean, I often say, look, sorry, the court doesn't care how you felt. The court is really not interested in that. The court's interested in X, Y, and Z. Often a very difficult thing for solicitors to say because the relationship is quite different. But if things are kept along those lines, simple, easy to read, you're less likely to get a judge who's going to say, oh, look, this is 50, 60 paragraphs long. How am I meant to read this when I've got a very busy list? Another criticism of some of the affidavits, and I remember Judge Dessau saying, oh, I wish practitioners wouldn't say, I refer to paragraph 37 of the respondent's affidavit and I deny that. Well, those sorts of things all detract from what you're trying to get across. You've got to make it simple. The judge has no idea without going back to paragraph 39 of the other party's affidavit to know what you're actually denying. So if it's started off with, what are you trying to achieve? How are you going to achieve it? What facts have you got in support of the issues you're trying to establish? Then it's a good starting point. And keep the client under control. As much as they might have a lot of things they want to tell the court, not relevant, not going to help them, and the shortest, quickest, simplest way home to what you want is usually the most powerful, and at the end of the day, less likely to involve tricky cross-examination of your client, and less likely then to perhaps have issues of credit and reliability as criticisms of your case. Thank you.